Some years ago, before giving serious thought to the value of the savings habit, I made a personal account of the money that had slipped through my fingers. The amount was so alarming that it resulted in the writing of this lesson, and adding the habit of saving as one of the 17 laws of success. Following is an itemized statement of this account. Inherited, invested in automobile supply business with a friend who lost the entire amount in 1 year, $4,000. Extra money earned from sundry writing for magazines and newspapers, all spent uselessly, $3,600. Earned from training 3,000 salesmen with the aid of the Law of Success philosophy, invested in a magazine that was not a success because there was no reserve capital back of it, $30,000. Extra money earned from public addresses, lectures, etc., all of which was spent as it came in, $3,400. Estimated amount that could have been saved during a period of 10 years out of regular earnings at the rate of only $50 a month, $6,000. Total, $47,000. This amount, had it been saved and invested as received in building and loan associations or some other manner that would have earned compound interest, would have grown into the sum of $94,000 at the time this lesson is being written. I have never been the victim of any of the usual habits such as gambling, drinking, and excessive entertaining. It is almost unbelievable that someone whose habits of living are reasonably moderate could spend $47,000 within a little over 10 years without having anything to show for the money, but it can be done. I recall one occasion when the president of a large corporation sent me a check for $500 for an address I delivered at a banquet given to the employees, and I distinctly recall what went through my mind when I opened the letter and saw the check. I had wanted a new automobile, and this check was exactly the amount required for the first payment. I had it spent before it had been in my hands 30 seconds. Perhaps this is the experience of the majority of people. They think more of how they are going to spend what they have than they do about ways and means of saving. The idea of saving and the self-control and self-sacrifice which must accompany it is always accompanied by thoughts of an unpleasant nature, but oh, how it does thrill one to think of spending. There is a reason for this, and that reason is the fact that most of us have developed the habit of spending while neglecting the habit of saving, and any idea that frequents the human mind but seldom is not as welcome as that which frequents it often. In truth, the habit of saving can be made as fascinating as the habit of spending, but not until it has become a regular, well-grounded, systematic habit. We like to do that which is often repeated, which is but another way of stating what the scientists have discovered, that we are victims of our habits. The habit of saving money requires more force of character than most people have developed, for the reason that saving means self-denial and sacrifice of amusements and pleasures in scores of different ways. For this very reason, one who develops the savings habit acquires, at the same time, many of the other needed habits which lead to success, especially self-control, self-confidence, courage, poise, and freedom from fear.
Though some people spend a great deal of money, it does not mean they are rich. In The Millionaire Next Door, Thomas J. Stanley and William Danko reveal that spending is something that most wealthy people avoid. Their research shows that more than 80% of America's millionaires accumulated their own wealth. They did not inherit it. Most millionaires do not live in fancy neighborhoods, but in the houses they owned when they began to accumulate their fortunes. Most millionaires drive mid-size American cars, not fancy imports, and one out of three of them always buys used cars. The average millionaire has an income of just over $130,000. Their real wealth comes from their habit of saving 20% of their income. In short, most millionaires are not actors or Fortune 500 CEOs or baseball players pulling down millions of dollars a season. They are people earning good but not fantastic incomes who have made a habit of saving.
How much should you save? The first question that will arise is, how much should one save? The answer cannot be given in a few words, for the amount one should save depends upon many conditions, some of which may be within one's control and some of which may not be. Generally speaking, a salaried worker should apportion his or her income about as follows. Savings account, 20%. Living, clothes, food, and shelter, 50%. Education, 10%. Recreation, 10%. Life insurance, 10%. For a total of 100%. The following, however, indicates the approximate distribution which the average person actually makes of his income. Savings account, nothing. Living, clothes, food, and shelter, 60%. Education, 0%. Recreation, 35%. Life insurance, 5%. For a total of 100%. An experienced analyst has stated that he could tell very accurately by examining anyone's personal monthly budget what sort of a life that person is living. Moreover, the analyst will get most of his information from looking at the recreation item. This, then, is a figure to be watched as carefully as the greenhouse keeper watches the thermometer that controls the life and death of his plants.
Careful analysis of 178 men who are known to be successful disclosed the fact that all had failed many times before arriving.
Nothing in this lesson is intended as a sermon on morality or on any other subject. We are here dealing with cold facts, which, to a large extent, constitute the building materials out of which success may be created. However, this is an appropriate place to state some facts which have such a direct bearing on the subject of achieving success that they cannot be omitted without weakening this entire course in general and this lesson in particular. I am speaking not as a reformer, nor am I preaching morals, as this field of useful endeavor is quite well covered by others who are able workers. What is here stated, therefore, is intended as a necessary part of a course of philosophy whose purpose is to mark a safe road over which one may travel to honorable achievement.
In the following section, Napoleon Hill goes on at length, citing examples of people spending their money on bootleg alcohol instead of saving. The editors have chosen to include these examples in this new edition as a short lesson in human nature. As you hear the following section, in your mind, replace the word liquor with the words drugs, video games, lottery tickets, or any other current fad or fashion. No doubt you will experience Hill's stories from 1927 suddenly becoming as contemporary as today's headlines.
During the year 1926, I was in partnership with the late Don R. Mellett, who was at the time the publisher of the Canton, Ohio Daily News. Mr. Mellett became interested in the law of success philosophy because it offered, as he believed, sound counsel to young men and young women who really wished to get ahead in life. Through the pages of the Daily News, Mr. Mellett was conducting a fierce battle against the underworld forces of Canton. With the aid of detectives and investigators, some of whom were supplied by the governor of Ohio, Mr. Mellett and I gathered accurate data concerning the way most of the people in Canton were living. In July 1926, Mr. Mellett was assassinated. During the investigation into crime conditions in Canton, all reports came to my office, and the data described below are therefore absolutely accurate. A teller in a bank, whose salary was $150 a month, was spending an average of $75 a month for liquor, and in addition to this unpardonable waste of money out of a salary which was none too great at most, he was traveling at a pace and with a crowd which meant ruin for him later on. The superintendent of a large manufacturing plant whose salary was $5,000 a year and who should have been saving at least $125 a month was actually saving nothing. His bootlegger's bill averaged $150 a month. A policeman whose income was $160 a month was spending over $400 a month on dinner parties at a nearby roadhouse. Where he got the difference between his legitimate income and his actual expenditures is a question that reflects no particular credit on the policeman. A young man who was attending high school was spending large sums for liquor. The actual amount was not obtainable for the reason that he paid cash as he got the liquor, and the bootlegger's records did not therefore disclose the actual amount. Later, this boy's parents had him locked up to save him from himself. It was found that he was stealing money from a savings fund kept by his mother somewhere about the house. He had stolen and spent more than $300 of this money when discovered. A few years ago, I set up a lecture bureau in 41 high schools where I lectured once a month during the entire school season. The principals of these high schools stated that less than 2% of the students showed any tendency towards saving money, and an examination through the aid of a questionnaire prepared for that purpose disclosed the fact that only 5% of the students out of a total of 11,000 of high school age believed that the savings habit was one of the essentials for success. It is no wonder the rich are becoming richer and the poor are becoming poorer.
According to the 1999 EBRI Youth and Money Survey, 64% of students say they do not know as much about money as they should. Even among students who say they do a very good job of managing their money, 49% think they should know more.
We are all victims of habit. Unfortunately for most of us, we are reared by parents who have no conception whatsoever of the psychology of habit, and without being aware of their fault, most parents aid and abet their offspring in the development of the spending habit by overindulgence with spending money and by lack of training in the habit of saving. The habits of early childhood cling to us all through life. Fortunate indeed is the child whose parents have the foresight and the understanding of the value as a character builder of the habit of saving to inculcate this habit in the minds of their children. It is a training that yields rich rewards. Give the average person a $100 windfall, and what will become of it? Why, the lucky person will begin to cogitate on how to spend the money. Dozens of things that are needed or perceived as necessary will flash into that person's mind. But it is a rather safe bet that it will never occur to the recipient, unless he or she has acquired the savings habit, to make this $100 the beginning of a savings account. Before night comes, the $100 will be spent, or at least a decision will have been made on how to spend it, thus adding more fuel to the already too bright flame of the habit of spending. We are ruled by our habits. It requires force of character, determination, and power of firm decision to open a savings account and then add to it a regular, if small, portion of all subsequent income.
All salespeople will do well to remember that no one wants anything that someone else is trying to get rid of.
There is one rule by which anyone may determine well in advance whether or not financial freedom and independence, which is so universally desired, is attainable, and this rule has absolutely nothing to do with the amount of one's income. The rule is that if you follow the systematic habit of saving a definite proportion of all money you earn or receive in other ways, you are practically sure to place yourself in a position of financial independence. If you save nothing, you are absolutely sure never to be financially independent, no matter how much your income may be. The one and only exception to this rule is that someone who does not save might possibly inherit such a large sum of money that he or she could not spend it, or might inherit it under a trust which would protect it. But these eventualities are rather remote, so much so, in fact, that you cannot rely upon such a miracle happening to you. I enjoy a rather close acquaintance with many hundreds of people throughout the United States and in some foreign countries. For nearly 25 years, I have been watching many of these acquaintances and know, therefore, from actual experience how they live, why some of them have failed while others have succeeded, and the reasons for both failure and success. This list of acquaintances covers men who control hundreds of millions of dollars and actually own many millions that they have acquired. Also men who have had millions of dollars, all of which passed through their fingers, and they are now penniless. For the purpose of showing the student of this philosophy just how the law of habit becomes a sort of pivotal point on which success or failure turns, and exactly why no one can become financially independent without developing the habit of systematic saving, the living habits of some of these many acquaintances will be described. We will begin with a complete history, in his own words, of a man who made $1 million in the field of advertising, but who was left with nothing to show for his efforts. This story first appeared in the American magazine. The tale is true in every respect, and it has been included as a part of this lesson because its author, Mr. W.C. Freeman, is willing to have his mistakes made public with the hope that others may avoid them. The following story is repeated by courtesy of the publishers of the American magazine. Copyright, the Crowell Publishing Company, 1927. A sad but true story. I have made $1 million, but I haven't got a cent. While it is embarrassing, yes, humiliating publicly to confess to an outstanding fault that has made a good deal of a mess of my life today, nevertheless, I have decided to make this confession for the good it may do. I am going to make a clean breast of how I let slip through my fingers all the money I have earned thus far in my lifetime, which approximates $1 million. This amount I made through my work in the field of advertising, except a few $1,000s I earned up to 25 years of age by teaching in country schools and by writing newsletters to some country weeklies and daily newspapers. Maybe $1 million does not seem a lot of money in these days of many millions and even billions, but it is a big sum of money just the same. If there are any who think to the contrary, let them count $1 million. I tried to figure out the other night how long it would take to do so. I found I could count an average of 100 a minute. On this basis, it would take me 20 days of 8 hours each, plus 6 hours and 40 minutes on the 21st day to do the stunt. I doubt very much if you or I were given an assignment to count 1 million $1 bills upon the promise that all of them would be ours at the end of that time that we could complete it. It would probably drive us mad, and a lot of use the money would be to us then, wouldn't it? Let me say at the outset of my story that I do not regret, not for 1 minute, that I spent 90% of the money I made. To wish any of this 90% back at this time would make me feel that I would have denied much happiness to my family and to many others. My only regret is that I spent all of my money and more besides. If I had today the 10% I could have saved easily, I would have $100,000 safely invested and no debts. If I had this money, I would feel really and truly that I was rich. And I mean just this, for I have never had a desire to accumulate money for money's sake. Those schoolteaching and newspaper correspondence days of mine brought some cares and responsibilities, but they were met optimistically. I married at the age of 21 with the full approval of parents on both sides who believed thoroughly in the doctrine preached by Henry Ward Beecher that early marriages are virtuous marriages. Just 1 month and 1 day after I was married, my father met a tragic death. He was suffocated by coal gas. Having been an educator all his life and one of the best, he had not accumulated any money. When he passed out of our family circle, it was up to all of us to pull together and get along somehow, which we did. Apart from the void left in our home by my father's death, my wife and I and my mother and only sister lived together. We had a joyful life, despite the fact that it was a tight squeeze to make ends meet. My mother, who was exceptionally talented and resourceful, she had taught school with my father until I was born, decided to open our home to a married couple, old friends of the family. They came to live with us and their board helped to pay expenses. My mother was known far and wide for the wonderful meals she served. Later on, two well-to-do women, friends of the family, were taken into our home, thus increasing our revenue. My sister helped very substantially by teaching a kindergarten class which met in the big living room of our home. My wife contributed her share to the household by taking charge of the sewing and mending. Those were very happy days. No one in the household was extravagant or had any extravagant tendencies except perhaps myself, for I was always inclined to be free with money. I liked to make gifts to the family and to entertain friends. When the first baby came into our home, a boy, we all thought heaven had opened its doors to us. My wife's parents, who took the keenest and deepest interest in our affairs and who were always ready to lend a helping hand, were equally happy over the coming of their first grandchild. My brother-in-law, much older than my wife and a bachelor, could not understand at first the joy we all felt, but even he began to strut around like a proud peacock after a while. What a difference a baby makes in a home.
Think well before you speak, because your words may plant the seed of either success or failure in the mind of some other person.
I am injecting these details into my story merely to emphasize how the early days of my life were lived. I had no opportunity to spend much money, and yet I had as much happiness in those days as I have ever had since. The strange thing about it all is that the experience of those days did not teach me the value of money. If anybody ever had a practical lesson to guide him in his future, I certainly had it. But let me tell you how this early experience affected me. The birth of my son inspired me to do something that would make more money than I was getting at teaching school and in writing for newspapers. I did not want my wife, mother, and sister to feel that they would have to continue indefinitely to do their part in sustaining the household. Why should a fellow, big and strong and healthy as I have always been, and with a reasonable amount of ability, be content to remain a spoke in the wheel? Why shouldn't I be the whole wheel, as far as providing for the family was concerned? Following my desire to make more money, I took on the selling of books in addition to teaching and writing for newspapers. This earned for me quite a little extra money. Finally, I gave up teaching and concentrated on selling books and writing for newspapers. My book selling took me to Bridgeton, New Jersey. It was here that I got my first real start in making money. I had to be away from home a great deal to do this work, but the sacrifice was worthwhile. I earned enough money in a few weeks to send more money home than I had contributed to the household in any year from my school teaching and newspaper correspondence. After combing the territory in the Bridgeton zone, I became interested in a newspaper in that city, the Morning Star. It seemed to me that the editor and publisher of this paper needed a helper. I called on him and told him so. He said, "Heavens, young man, how can I hire you? I am not earning enough money to pay for my own living." "That's just it," said I. "I believe together we can make the Star a success. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll work for you for 1 week for $1 a day. At the end of the week, if I have made good, I'll expect you to pay me $3 a day for the second week. And then if I continue to do well, I'll expect you to pay me $6 a day for the third week, and will continue from then on until the paper makes enough money to pay me $50 a week." The owner agreed to my proposition. At the end of 2 months, I was being paid $50 a week, which in those days was considered a big salary. I began to feel that I was well on my way toward making money, but all I wanted it for was to make my family more comfortable. $50 a week was just four times as much as I had made teaching school. My job on the Star embraced editorial writing, not very brilliant, reporting, just ordinary, writing and selling of advertisements, fairly successful, proofreading, bill collecting, and so forth. It kept me humping 6 days a week. But I could stand it, for I was strong and healthy, and besides, the work was very interesting. I also contributed correspondence to the New York Sun, Philadelphia Record, and the Trenton, New Jersey Times, which brought me an average of $150 a month, for this was a good news territory. I learned a lesson on the Star that eventually shaped the course of my life. I found out there is a great deal more money to be earned by selling advertising for newspapers than in writing for them. Advertising brings grist to the mill. I put over one advertising stunt on the Star, a write-up of the South Jersey oyster industry paid for by the oysterman that brought in $3,000 cash, which the publisher divided with me 50-50. I had never seen so much money at one time in all my life. Think of it, $1,500. 25% more than I had made in 2 years of school teaching and odd tasks. Did I save this money or any part of it? I did not. What was the use? I could do so much with it to make my wife, boy, mother, and sister happy that I let it go far easier than I had made it. But would it not have been a fine thing if I had put this money away for a rainy day? My work in Bridgeton attracted the attention of Sam Hudson, New Jersey correspondent of the Philadelphia Record, who was a shining example of that type of newspaperman whose greatest pleasure in life is doing things for others. Sam told me that it was time for me to get located in a big city. He thought I had it in me to make good. He said he would get me a job in Philadelphia. He did, and I moved with my wife and baby to Germantown. I was given charge of the advertising department of the Germantown Philadelphia Gazette, a weekly newspaper. At the start, I did not make as much money as I had earned in Bridgeton because I had to give up my newspaper correspondence. The news for this section was covered by other correspondents. But very soon I was making 25% more money. The Gazette increased its size 3 times to accommodate its advertising, and each time I received a very substantial increase in salary. In addition to this, I was given a job to gather social news for the Sunday edition of the Philadelphia Press. Bradford Merrill, managing editor of that newspaper, now a very important New York newspaper executive, assigned me a big territory to cover. This kept me busy every night in the week except Saturdays. I was paid $5 a column, but I averaged 7 columns every Sunday, which made me $35 a week extra. It was more money for me to spend, and I spent it. I did not know anything about budgeting my expenses. I just let it go as it came. I did not have time, or thought I hadn't, to watch my step in spending. A year later, I was invited to join the advertising staff of the Philadelphia Press, a big opportunity for a young man, for I got wonderful training under the management of William L. McLean, now the owner of the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin. I still retained my job as gatherer of social news, so my income was just about the same as I had been making in Germantown. But before long, my work attracted the attention of James Elverson Sr., publisher of the old Saturday Night and Golden Days, who had just purchased the Philadelphia Inquirer. I was offered and accepted the advertising management of this newspaper. This meant a big increase in my income, and soon afterward there came a happy increase in my family, the birth of a daughter. Then I was able to do what I had longed to do since the birth of my son. I got the family together again under one roof, my wife and two babies, my mother and sister. At last I was able to relieve my mother of any cares or responsibilities, and never again did she have either, as long as she lived. She died in her 81st year, 25 years after my father's death. I shall never forget her last words to me, "Will, you have never caused me a moment's worry since you were born, and I could not have had more than you have given me had I been the Queen of England."
I am thankful for the adversities that have crossed my pathway, for they have taught me tolerance, sympathy, self-control, perseverance, and some other virtues I might never have known.
I was making at this time 4 times more money than my father had made as superintendent of public schools in my hometown of Phillipsburg, New Jersey. All the money, however, passed out of my pockets as easily as water flows through a sieve. Expenses increased with every increase in my income, which is the habit, I suppose, with most people. There was no sane reason, though, for letting my expenses go beyond my income, which I did. I found myself piling up debts, and from this time on I was never out of debt. I did not worry about my debts, though, for I thought I could pay them off at any time. It never occurred to me, not until fully 25 years later, that debt eventually would bring upon me not only great anxiety and unhappiness, but that I would lose friends and credit as well. But I must pat myself on the back for one thing. I was giving full rein to my big fault, spending money as fast as I made it, often faster. But I never shirked my work. I was always trying to find more things to do, and I always found them. I spent very little time with my family. I would go home to dinner every night and romp with the babies until their bedtime, then I would return to the office and often work. So the years went by. Another daughter arrived. Presently, I wanted my daughters to have a pony and cart, and I wanted my son to have a riding horse. Then I thought I needed a team to take me around with the family. I got them all. Instead of one horse and a carry-all, or perhaps a team which would have been sufficient for our needs and something we could have afforded, I had to have a stable with all that goes with it. This outfit cost me nearly 1/4 of my annual income. Then I took up golf. This was in my 41st year. I went at my play the same as I went at my work, put my whole heart in it. I learned to play pretty well. My son and elder daughter played with me, and they learned to play well, too. It was necessary that my younger daughter should spend the winter in the South and summers in the Adirondacks. But instead of her mother going with her alone, I felt it would be fine if the son and other daughter went along with them. This arrangement was carried out. They went to Pinehurst, North Carolina, every winter, and to expensive resorts in the Adirondacks or New Hampshire in the summer. All this took a great deal of money. My son and elder daughter were keen about golf and spent a lot of money on it. I also disbursed quite a little on golf courses around New York. Between the three of us, we won 80 prizes, most of which are now in storage. I sat down one day and calculated what these prizes had cost me. I discovered that each trophy had cost me $250, or a total of $45,000 over a period of 15 years, an average of $3,000 a year. Ridiculous, wasn't it? I entertained lavishly at my home. Montclair folks thought I was a millionaire. I frequently invited groups of businessmen to have a day of golf at the club and then to have dinner with me in the evening. They would have been satisfied with a plain home dinner, but no, I must serve them an elaborate affair staged by a famous caterer. These dinners never cost less than $10 a plate, which did not include the money spent for music while they were dining. I had a quartet come to the house. Our dining room comfortably seated 20 people, and it was filled to capacity many times. It was all very lovely, and I was glad to be their host. In fact, I was very happy over it. I never stopped to think how rapidly I was piling up debts. The day came when they began to bother me a lot. I had entertained so many guests at the golf club one month, paying for luncheons, cigars, and greens fees, that my bill was $450. This attracted the attention of the directors of the club, who were all good friends of mine and very much interested in my welfare. They made it their business to tell me that I was spending entirely too much money, and they wished for my sake that I could check my expenses. This gave me a bit of a jolt. It made me think seriously long enough to get rid of my horses and traps, at a big sacrifice, of course. I gave up our home and moved back to the city, but I did not leave any unpaid bills in Montclair. I borrowed the money to pay them. It was always easy for me to get all the money I wanted, despite my well-known financial shortcomings. Here are two sidelights on my experience during my flaring 40s. Besides spending money foolishly, and perhaps recklessly, I loaned it with equal abandon. In cleaning out my desk at home before moving to the city, I looked over a package of due bills, the total of which was over $40,000. That was money handed out to just anybody who came along. I tore them all up. But I realized that if I had that money in hand, I wouldn't owe a dollar. One of the prosperous businessmen I had entertained many times, and who in turn had entertained me, said to me, "Billy, I've got to stop going on outings with you. You spend entirely too much money for me. I can't keep up with you." Think of that, coming from a man who was making more money than I was. It should have struck home, but it didn't. I went on spending just the same and foolishly thinking that I was having a good time and with no thought of the future. This man is now one of the vice presidents of one of New York's greatest financial institutions and is reported to be worth many millions of dollars. I should have taken his advice.
Fortunate is the person who has learned that the most certain way to get is to first give through some sort of useful service.
In the fall of 1908, after my disastrous experience of 6 months in another line of business following my resignation from the Hearst organization, I resumed newspaper work as advertising manager of the New York Evening Mail. I had known Henry L. Stoddard, editor and owner, back in the Philadelphia days when he was political correspondent for the press. Despite the fact that I was bothered by debts, I did the best work of my life on the Evening Mail, and made more money during the 5 years I was associated with it than I had ever made before. Moreover, Mr. Stoddard gave me the privilege of syndicating advertising talks which ran in his paper for 1,000 consecutive publication days, and earned for me more than $55,000. Mr. Stoddard was very generous in many other ways, and frequently paid me special sums of money for doing what he considered unusual things in the way of developing business. During this period, I was so deeply in debt that, in order to keep things moving as smoothly as possible, but without retrenching in the slightest way in my expenses, I borrowed money from Peter to pay Paul, and from Paul to pay Peter. That item of $55,000 earned from syndicating advertising talks would have more than paid all my debts and left a nice nest egg besides. But all of it was spent as easily as though I hadn't a care in the world. In 1915, I went on my own in the advertising business. From that time until the spring of 1922, my fees ran into very big figures. I was still making more money than I ever did, and I was spending it just as fast as I made it until finally my friends got tired of making me loans. If I had shown the slightest inclination to curb my expenses to the extent of only 10%, these wonderful men would have been willing to divide 50-50 with me, letting me pay them 5% of it and saving 5%. They did not care so much about the return of the money they had loaned me, as that they wanted to see me pull myself together. The crash in my affairs came 5 years ago. Two friends who had stood by me loyally became impatient and told me frankly that I needed a drastic lesson. They gave it to me all right. I was forced into bankruptcy, which nearly broke my heart. I felt that every person I knew was pointing the finger of scorn at me. This was very foolish. While there was comment, it was not at all unfriendly. It was expressive of keen regret that a man who had attained so much prestige in his profession and had earned so much money should have allowed himself to get into financial difficulties. Proud and sensitive to the core, I felt the disgrace of bankruptcy so keenly that I decided to go to Florida, where I had once done a special piece of work for a client. It seemed to me to be the coming El Dorado. I figured that maybe I could make sufficient money in a few years so that I could return to New York not only with a competency, but with enough to pay all my debts in full. For a time, it looked as though I would realize this ambition, but I was caught in the big real estate collapse. So here I am, back in the old town where I once had big earning power and hundreds of friends and well-wishers. It has been a strange experience. One thing is certain. I have learned my lesson at last. I feel sure that opportunities will come my way to redeem myself and that my earning power will be restored to me. And when that time comes, I know that I shall be able to live as well as I ever did on 40% of my income. Then I shall divide the remaining 60% into two parts, setting aside 30% to pay my creditors and 30% for insurance and savings. If I allowed myself to feel depressed over my past or filled my mind with worries, I would not be capable of carrying on the fight to redeem myself. Besides, I would be ungrateful to my Maker for having endowed me with wonderful health all my life. Is there any greater blessing? I would be ungrateful to the memory of my parents whose splendid training has kept me anchored pretty safely to moral standards. Slipping from moral moorings is infinitely more serious in the end than slipping from the thrift standard. I would lack appreciation for the encouragement and support I have had in generous measure from hundreds of businessmen and to many good friends who helped me build a fine reputation in my profession. These memories are the sunshine of my life, and I shall use them to pave the way to my future achievement. With abundance of health, unfaltering faith, unflagging energy, unceasing optimism, and unbounded confidence that a man can win his fight, even though he commences late in life to realize the kind of fight he must make, is there anything but death to stop him? Mr. Freeman's story is the same as that which might be told by thousands of others who save nothing, with the exception that the amounts of their incomes would vary. The manner of living, the way the money was spent, and why, as told in Mr. Freeman's narrative, show the way the spender's mind works. The installment plan of buying has become so common, and it is so easy to purchase practically anything one desires that the tendency to spend out of proportion to one's income is rapidly increasing. This tendency must be curbed by the person who has made up his mind to gain financial independence. It can be done by anyone who is willing to try.
I am thankful that I was born poor, that I did not come into this world burdened by the whims of wealthy parents with a bag of gold around my neck.
There is no virtue in keeping up with the pace set by neighbors when this means sacrifice of the habit of saving a regular part of one's income. It is far better in the long run to be considered a bit behind the times than it is to go along through youth into the days of maturity and finally into old age without having formed the habit of systematic saving. It is a common practice today for families to purchase automobiles on monthly payments which involve too great an expenditure compared to their income. If you have a Ford income, you have no business purchasing a more expensive car. You should curb your desires and content yourself with a Ford. Many people spend their entire incomes and often go into debt besides because they maintain automobiles out of keeping with their incomes. This common practice is fatal to success as far as financial independence may be considered a part of success in thousands of instances. It is better to sacrifice during the age of youthfulness than it is to be compelled to do so during the age of maturity, as all who have not developed the habit of saving generally have to do. There is nothing quite so humiliating that carries such great agony and suffering as poverty in old age when personal services are no longer marketable and one must turn to relatives or to charitable institutions for existence. A budget system should be maintained by every person, both the married and the single. But no budget system will work out if the person trying to keep it lacks the courage to cut expenses on such items as those of entertainment and recreation. If you feel so weak in willpower that you think it necessary to keep up with the Joneses, with whom you associate socially, and whose income is greater than your own, or who spend all of their income foolishly, then no budget system can be of service to you. Forming the savings habit means that to some extent at least you must seclude yourself from all except a well-selected group of friends who enjoy you without elaborate entertaining on your part. To admit that you lack the courage to trim down your expenditures so that you can save money, even if only a small amount, is the equivalent of admitting at the same time a lack of the sort of character which leads to success. It has been proved, times too numerous to be mentioned, that people who have formed the habit of saving money are always given preference in positions of responsibility. Therefore, the saving of money not only adds advantages in the nature of preferred employment and a larger bank account, but it also increases the actual earning capacity. Any businessman will prefer to employ a person who saves money regularly, not because of the mere fact that such a person saves money, but because of the characteristics possessed by such a person which make him or her more efficient. It should be a common practice for all business houses to require all employees to save money. This would be a blessing to thousands of people who would not otherwise have the willpower to form the savings habit. Henry Ford has gone a very long way, perhaps as far as is expedient, to induce his employees not only to save their money, but to spend what they do spend wisely and to live sanely and economically. The manager who induces his employees to form the habit of saving is a practical philanthropist.
The SMART course is to resolve to save a certain percentage of every check that comes to you. This is called paying yourself first. While 20% may seem to be daunting, it will become easier to manage as you experience the excitement of watching your savings grow. If your current situation absolutely will not allow you to set aside 20%, select another amount, even just 5%. Out of every $1,000, this is just $50. But repeat that 5% savings 10 times, and you will have $500. Isn't the notion of having $500 tucked away appealing? You will find that as you watch your savings grow, you will feel a sense of self-confidence. You will realize that you are capable of saving. What would happen, you will ask, if I were saving 10% or even 15%? Soon, 20% will seem far more attainable. You should strive to reach a point where you have at least 3 months' take-home pay in your savings account. This will provide you with an important cushion should some unexpected difficulty occur. Even better, a year's worth of living expenses set aside will bring you an incredible sense of freedom. If you have nothing more in the bank than what it will take to get you through next week, this will seem an enormous goal to you. Even by setting aside 20% of your income, you will still need almost 5 years to reach this level of savings. But if you do nothing, in 5 years you will still be as strapped for cash as you are today. Perhaps your friends will wonder why you're driving the same car or why you haven't gone on a Caribbean vacation. Perhaps they will tell you stories about their new satellite television system or the skiing in Aspen. The fear of criticism may assail you in such times, but if these people are measuring you solely by how extravagantly you spend your money, perhaps they aren't the best of friends. Avoid the temptation of boasting about your savings activities. Unless you are embarking on a business relationship, this is no one else's concern. It's too easy to find yourself the butt of dumb jokes about being a skinflint or the target of a so-called friend who comes, hat in hand, for a loan that you will never see repaid. Learn more about what you can do with your savings. There are many good guides to money management. One reason for accumulating savings is that it can be very useful to you in pursuing your definite chief aim. When the time comes to embark upon such a pursuit, be sure to hold back a part of your savings. Few people leap to success in a single smooth movement. There will be surprises and probably some setbacks along the way. Keeping a cushion ready gives you the resiliency to bounce back from disappointment and take advantage of the lessons it has taught you. Your commitment to the habit of saving will prepare you to embrace and use all the lessons of the law of success.
Opportunities that come to those who have saved money. A few years ago, a young man came to Philadelphia from the farming district of Pennsylvania and went to work in a printing plant. One of his fellow workmen owned some shares in a building and loan company and had formed the habit of saving $5 a week through this association. This young man was influenced by his associate to open an account with the building and loan company. At the end of 3 years, he had saved $900. The printing plant for which he worked got into financial difficulty and was about to fail. He came to the rescue with his $900, which he had saved in small amounts, and in return was given a half interest in the business. By inaugurating a system of close economy, he helped the business to pay off its indebtedness, and today he is drawing out of it, as his half of the profits, a little better than $25,000 a year. This opportunity never would have come, or if it had, he would not have been prepared to embrace it had he not formed the habit of saving money. When the Ford automobile was perfected, during the early days of its existence, Henry Ford needed capital to promote the manufacture and sale of his product. He turned to a few friends who had saved up a few $1,000s, one of whom was Senator Cousins. These friends came to his rescue, put in a few $1,000s with him, and later drew out millions of dollars in profits. When Woolworth first started his 5- and 10-cent stores plan, he had no capital. But he turned to a few friends who had saved, by the closest sort of economy and great sacrifice, a few $1,000s. These friends staked him, and later they were paid back hundreds of thousands of dollars in profits. Van Heusen, the famed shirt manufacturer, conceived the idea of producing a semi-soft collar for men. His idea was sound, but he had not a cent to promote it. He turned to a few friends who had only a few $100s who gave him a start, and the collar made each of them wealthy. The men who started the El Producto cigar business had but little capital, and what they did have was money they had saved from their small earnings as cigar makers. They had a good idea, and knew how to make a good cigar, but the idea would have died a-borning had they not saved a little money. With their meager savings, they launched the cigar, and a few years later they sold out their business to the American Tobacco Company for $8 million. Back of practically every great fortune, one may find, as its beginning, a well-developed habit of saving money. John D. Rockefeller was an ordinary bookkeeper. He conceived the idea of developing the oil business, which was then not even considered a business. He needed capital, and because he had developed the habit of saving and had thereby proved that he could conserve the funds of other people, he had no difficulty in borrowing what money he needed. It may be truthfully stated that the real basis of the Rockefeller fortune is the habit of saving money that Mr. Rockefeller developed while working as a bookkeeper at a salary of $40 a month. James J. Hill was a poor young man working as a telegrapher at a salary of $30 a month. He conceived the idea of the Great Northern Railway System, but his idea was out of proportion to his ability to finance. However, he had formed the habit of saving money, and on the meager salary of $30 a month had saved enough to enable him to pay his expenses on a trip to Chicago, where he interested capitalists in financing his plan. The fact that he himself had saved money on a small salary was considered good evidence that he would be a safe man to trust with other people's money. Most people in business will not trust another person with their money unless that person has demonstrated an ability to take care of his own and use it wisely. The test, while it is often embarrassing to those who have not formed the habit of saving, is a very practical one. A young man who worked in a printing plant in the city of Chicago wanted to open a small print shop and go into business for himself. He went to a printing supply house manager and made known his wants, saying he desired credit for a printing press and some type and other small equipment. The first question asked by the manager was, "Have you saved any money of your own?" He had. Out of a salary of $30 a week, he had saved $15 a week regularly for nearly 4 years. He got the credit he wanted. Later on, he got more credit. Until today, he has built up one of the most successful printing plants in the city of Chicago. His name is George B. Williams. Many years after this incident, I became acquainted with Mr. Williams, and at the end of the war in 1918, I went to Mr. Williams and asked for credit amounting to many thousands of dollars for the purpose of publishing the Golden Rule magazine. The first question asked was, "Have you formed the habit of saving money?" Despite the fact that all the money I had saved was lost in the war, the mere fact that I had actually formed the saving habit was the real basis on which I got credit for upward of $30,000. There are opportunities on every corner. but they exist only for those who have ready money, or who can command money because they have formed the habit of saving and developed the other characteristics which go with the formation of the savings habit known by the general term of character.
Love and justice are the real arbiters of all disputes. Give them a chance, and you will no longer want to defeat a brother sojourner by the wayside of life.
The late J.P. Morgan once said he would rather loan $1 million to a man of sound character who had formed the habit of saving money than he would $1,000 to a man without character who was a spendthrift. Generally speaking, this is the attitude which the world takes toward all those who save money. It often happens that a small savings account of no more than $200 or $300 is sufficient to start one on the highway to financial independence. A few years ago, a young inventor invented a household article which was unique and practical. He was handicapped, as inventors so often are, because he did not have the money to market his invention. Moreover, not having formed the savings habit, he found it impossible to borrow money through banking sources. His roommate was a young machinist who had saved $200. He came to the inventor's aid with this small sum of money and had enough of the articles manufactured to give them a start. They went out and sold from house to house the first supply, then came back and had another supply made up, and so on, until they had accumulated, thanks to the thrift and savings ability of the roommate, a capital of $1,000. With this, plus some credit they secured, they bought the tools for manufacturing their own product. The young machinist sold his half interest in the business 6 years later for $250,000. He never would have handled this much money during his entire life had he not formed the habit of saving which enabled him to come to the rescue of his inventor friend. This case might be multiplied 1,000 times with but slight variation as to details, as it is fairly descriptive of the beginning of many great fortunes that have been made and are now in the making in the United States. It may seem like a sad, cruel fact, but it is a fact, nonetheless, that if you have no money and have not developed the habit of saving, you are out of luck as far as availing yourself of the opportunity to make money is concerned.
There may be times when you find that even having saved money, it is difficult to persuade others to back you, simply because your vision is greater than theirs. Women entrepreneurs, unfortunately, have often had this experience. But a small savings account of no more than a few $1,000s can be enough to get you started. Mary Kay Ash started her cosmetics company with $5,000 of her own money. Lillian Vernon began with $2,000 she had saved. They created opportunities by their habit of saving.
It can do no harm to repeat. In fact, it should be repeated over and over again that the real start of nearly all fortunes, whether great or small, is the formation of the habit of saving money. Get this basic principle firmly founded in your mind and you will be well on the road toward financial independence. It is a sad sight to see someone well along in years who is self-sentenced to the wearisome treadmill of hard labor because he or she has neglected to form the habit of saving money. Yet there are millions of such men and women of all ages and types living in the United States alone today. The greatest thing in life is freedom. There can be no real freedom without a reasonable degree of financial independence. It is a terrible thing to be compelled to be at a certain place, at a certain task, perhaps a task which one does not like for a certain number of hours every working day of the week, for a whole lifetime. In some ways, this is the same as being in prison, since one's choice of action is always limited. It is really no better than being in prison, with the privilege of a trustee, and in some ways it is even worse, because the person who is imprisoned has escaped the responsibility of providing a place to sleep, something to eat, and clothes to wear. The only hope of escape from this lifelong toil which curtails freedom is to form the habit of saving money, and then live up to that habit no matter how much sacrifice it may require. There is no other way out for millions of people, and unless you are one of the rare exceptions, this lesson and all these statements of fact are meant for you and apply to you. As William Shakespeare wrote, "Neither a borrower nor a lender be, For loan oft loses both itself and friend, and borrowing dulls the edge of husbandry. This above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man.